Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
Love Sculpture, Love the name of that band, with Dave Edmunds and a song called Sabre Dance, which was their second single released in 1968 on the Parlophone record label. That got to number 5 in the UK charts in December 1968. And it was also released on the second and final album, Forms and Feelings, in January 1970. A Welsh rock blues rock band.
Well, I can remember seeing him on Top of the Pops.
What? Performing this song?
Performing this song, yeah. Not the... And I can't remember because it's in the mists of time. The mists of time.
Okay.
But I can remember when I first went to school and I was watching it on TV one night.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, that is really cool. And I love this scale, you know, and that funny scale. And I'm going to get shot down here, I'm absolutely sure. But I think it's a double harmonic minor. And it's like the what you would call the gypsy scale, or it's a Hungarian thing, you know. And I use that an awful lot when on the if I'm doing some sort of song and it's a 5-chord comes up. I'll stick that in at the end and I use it quite a lot. So there we are. But that is that. And the reason why I use it is because of this song. Because I love that. It's sort of got a Spanish, you know what I mean now, don't you?
Yeah.
It's got that thing. And if you listen to it, it's exactly the same thing. And what I love about this is that it's so raw. Because he's obviously using some boxy old amp. Because it's a horrible guitar. It's very vicious, you know. And it sort of goes out and it pokes you in the eye. It doesn't sort of warm you nicely or gently, you know, croon you. It comes out and just pokes you in the eye and says, like a snapping little terrier on your trouser leg. Going, that's what it sounds like.
I know what you mean.
I think it's some sort of small, tiny Vox, that's what it sounds like, but loads of fuzz on it and, you know. But what a speed as well, tremendous.
Well, they were saying as well, this song is a reworking of a Soviet Armenian composer Aram Khachaturian.
Blimey.
Yeah, Khachaturian's classical piece, Sabre Dance. And it was a speed-crazed rock number inspired by Keith Emerson. And his classical arrangements, you see. And it ended up being a bit of a fluke hit because John Peel was so impressed when he heard it. He played it twice in one show on his Top Gear show.
Is that right?
Yeah, so it became one of their fluke hits because a lot of people say, really, that the band, Love Sculpture, was really just like a showpiece for Dave Edmunds' guitar talents because after that, really, I mean, they did loads of blues covers, reverently.
Yeah.
And then after that, obviously, he had I Hear You Knocking and he's had that sort of relationship with Nick Lowe. Was it
Nick Lowe? That's right. Yeah. Was that Dave Edmunds' Rock Pilot?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Woo!
That was the name of the band, wasn't it? Rock
Pilot. I remember that as well. I was so chuffed.
We've had him on a few times, haven't we? We've had Nick Lowe and Dave Edmunds on before with Rockpile, but this is the first time we've had Love Sculpture on, I think.
It's quite virtuoso and it's almost comedic, isn't it, as well? So it does make you smile. And we thought it would be a really good way to start the show, just to kind of rev it up.
Well, it's furious, isn't it? It's a furious song.
Standing on the corner, suitcase in my hand, Jackson's corset, Jane is in her vest, and me, I'm in a rock and roll band. Huh. Riding a Studs Bearcat Jim, you know, those were different times. All the poets, they studied rules of verse, and those ladies, they rolled their eyes. CJ, oh, CJ, oh, CJ. I tell you something, Jack, he is a banker. Both of them save their monies, and when they come home from work, ooh, sitting down by the fire, the radio does play the classical music, their jam, the march of the wooden soldiers, all your protesters, you can hear Jack say,
go out dancing, and other people say have to work. Just watch me now. And there's even some evil mothers. Well, they're gonna tell you that everything is just dirt. You know that women never really feign, and that villains always blink their eyes. Ooh. And that, you know, children are the only ones who blush, and that life is just to die.
Velvet Underground and Sweet Jane from their fourth studio album, Loaded. I wonder why that was. Released on the 15th of November 1970 of Atlantic Records subsidiary label Cotillion.
We.
What do you think about that?
Wow. I really like that. I love that song, actually. It's really still fresh, isn't it?
It is. What, you know, and what I hear in that, I hear that very repetitive... Because basically, you're singing the verse over the and the chorus over the same chord. You know, it's a repetitive thing, very much like you hear with Iggy Pop, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and he did a lot of that with the Stooges. And what always strikes me about that song though is the volume of that synth when it comes in. It sounds like somebody's made a mistake. It comes, and you think, what is that? Because the guitar is like, it's quite driving all the way through. It's, you know, nicely played, actually. It's like, to keep it as consistent as that, it's compressed to hell, but it sounds really nice. And, you know, Lou Reed's fantastic. But it's a great hook, isn't it?
I miss him. I think I spent most of that song missing him, actually. Isn't it weird? I was just thinking, oh, bananas. Because... I guess, in a way, I wish I'd have been around at that time because I think it would have been really inspirational because they were like, I mean, they broke so much new territory, didn't they? And they just were consistently brilliant for those few albums. And I think they called it Loaded, apparently, because Atlantic Records wanted them to write an album full of hits, loaded with hits, I think the quote was. So
is
they
that
called
right?
it, yeah. So I think it marked a sort of a departure away from more of the Warhol-influenced music, and it was more... aimed at getting hits, I think.
Well, John Cale had left by this time, and did Lou Reed...
After this, he left, yeah.
Right, okay.
So it was over. I think it was just the last one, really.
Because White Light, White Heat, I mean, that album was, you know... And those very early ones. But the thing about Velvet Underground, everybody says they launched about 1,000 bands.
Yeah.
But they weren't very commercially successful themselves, were they?
No, but they were saying, actually... Can I just read you this bit? Because I
love
this.
Yeah.
It kind of really sums them up in a way that helps me understand as well. They were saying that few rock groups can claim to have broken so much new territory and maintained such consistent brilliance on record as the Velvet Underground. It was the group's lot to be ahead of, or at least out of step with their time.
Right.
And that inspires me. And the mid to late 60s was an era of explosive growth and experimentation in rock, but the Velvet's innovations that kind of blended the energy of rock with the sonic adventurism of the avant-garde introduced a new degree of social realism and sexual kinkiness into rock lyrics.
Mm.
And they were too abrasive for the mainstream to handle, which I get. Completely, actually,
and,
at that time.
And I think Ronno and David Bowie, when Lou Reed did Transformer, of course,
yeah,
they sort of took that sexual thing and that whole energy from that record and put it and made it more palatable, didn't they? You know, because that Transformer record is just fantastic, you know, beautifully produced. But what I do like about this as well is the production, because it was done at Atlantic Studios. And if you think about it, at this time, Led Zeppelin had released three records. At this time, 1970. So they'd already done three albums on Atlantic. So they were, careering around America. And then you have this going on, which is quite different. And it's almost, is it proto-punk? I don't know. But it's proto-something. It's like, it's art rock. It's all those things, you know. Because there was a woman on drums as well. And apparently she had to leave because she was on maternity leave just after it finished, I think.
There was something to do with that. I think one of the albums that they didn't have her. I don't know whether she was on this one or not. But she
I think she was, yeah.
Yeah. So it's
great though, because that was really, I mean, a very unusual thing, because they worked with Nico as well, you know, and the whole influence with Warhol. An amazing time in American music, I think, quite different than the Motown and all the black stuff that was going on. You know, this is, you know, it's a very very New York sound, isn't it? You know.
Ooh.
The Rolling Stones and Miss You. And that was released as a single by the band themselves on their Rolling Stones record label in May 1978, a month before they released their 14th British and 16th American studio album called Some Girls. And they went to number one on the American Billboard Hot 100 charts, but only got to number three in the UK singles charts. And I wanted to ask you, guess which songs held them off number one and number two spots in the UK at that point when this was released?
78?
Yep. Whoa. May 1978.
It's not something like Show Up Your Face, is it, by that?
No.
Rennie and Renata, I don't know. No. Go on. Go on.
Okay. So at number two was The Rivers of Babylon.
Okay.
And number one for many weeks, because I looked through, I specifically researched this. You're the One That I Want.
No.
Yep. And it was number one for like six weeks. So basically, yep, John Travolta and Olivia Newton-John kept the Rolling Stones from getting up on
the
Rivers of Babylon.
Well, it's a great film, but you know.
Isn't that incredible though, at that time? And it's interesting because you wouldn't necessarily pitch that song at that point in time, would you? Because it's still, it's still kind of sexy and right now.
Well, I was trying to ignore those first two ones because, of course, Grease was not on my radar or anything like that.
What, I would say it five times, you know, when it came out.
I am absolutely sure you did, darling. Yes. We watched it together, I think, a couple of times. But I remember when this came out and I stormed out of the car with outrage. I said, the Stones have gone disco. And I was there and I just couldn't understand. And then, of course, it started to grow on me. And of course, you know, I was listening later on to Nile Rodgers and all that. And of course, old Nile would have had Charlie Watts' foot off for that, because in the middle break there, in the middle eight section, he doesn't play the fourth on the floor all the way through. He does a number of random kick drums, which of course, you know, in pure disco, you just don't do.
No.
Because when Chic were recording, I remember reading an interview with him, he said that Tony Thompson arrived, which is, of course, one of the marvellous drummer, and now Rodgers confiscated his toms and his cymbals, and he says, you won't be needing these in this band. So hi-hat, snare drum and kick drum, there we are, with Bernard Edwards on bass. But yeah, anyway, back to the songs. And you know, but the bass line, I think, is a really great, it's one of those hooks, because that is a hook on this song, isn't it?
Well, apparently Mick Jagger wrote this with Billy Preston, but on the writing credits, actually, they were preparing and doing some rehearsals for their El Mocambo Club gigs back in March 97.
Okay.
But at that time, Keith Richards always got co-writing credits, regardless of who wrote it.
Yeah, so Bill Linda McCartney, didn't it?
Yeah, but no, not necessarily, because Bill Wyman actually wrote the bass line for that.
Right.
And he said that he had to go and visit a load of clubs to try and get the groove right.
Right.
So it took him a little while to kind of, and I was listening to the bass line, and it's really quite interesting, actually.
It's lovely. Woo! I thought you were listening to the bass. But what I do love about that is that breakdown in the middle, it goes to the kick drum, you know. And actually, it's a very, the groove is not at all American. You can tell it's sort of kind of Charlie Watts. It's actually got a British sound to it in a funny sort of way, because he's playing it. But when that snare drum comes in, you know, that backbeat, and we were just watching a documentary the other night on the backbeat, weren't we? You know,
yeah,
on
exactly.
Drums with Stuart Copeland. That's right, yeah. And when that comes in, it really starts to move the track again. You know, it's great.
What was it called again? Because, you know, you watch that documentary, and it's Stuart Copeland. I can't remember.
It's on drums. BBC, yeah.
And what was fascinating about it is just the invention of the drum pedal, which changed everything. And just watch it, and it'll talk about the groove and the backbeat, and how the sound derived as well, the kind of groove from Congo Square and New Orleans. But it's lovely because he actually goes there. And I don't want to spoil it for you, but I just think it was actually just the most refreshing piece to put all the things you kind of know, but put it together and have a few surprises as well. It was a beautiful program to watch.
And Tina Weymouth on bass as well.
Exactly. You don't have to be really musical. You don't have to know loads of stuff. It's actually
very entertaining.
Accessible for any level of any kind of understanding, which I love.
But back to the Stones,
yeah.
Of course, Ian McLagan, ex-Faces, was playing the Wurlitzer on this, wasn't he?
Yeah, and also Mel Collins, who used to be in King Crimson, was doing the sax solo.
No, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. And Sugar Blue, the harp player, apparently Mick Jagger found him busking on the streets of Paris.
Yeah, it's a lovely part.
Beautiful, isn't it? And guess what? This made me laugh when I read it. In a final proof of the unjustness that rules the universe, the Stones have had half as many number one single hits as Westlife.
Morning fair, I took the air down by Blackwater side. 'Twas in gazing off all around me, the Irish lad I spied. Through the far part of the night, we lay in sport and a play, till this young man arose and forgathered his clothes, saying farewell to that's not the promise that you gave to me when first you lay on my breast. You could make me believe with your lying tongue that the sun rose in the west. Go home to your father's garden, go home and weep your fill, and think on your own misfortune that you've brought with your wants and will. Small and fair, I took the air down by Blackwater side. 'Twas in gazing off all around me, the Irish lad I spied.
Bert Jansch, Black Waterside, from the third studio album, Jack Orion, released on September 1966 on the Transatlantic record label, produced by Bill Leader.
Wow.
Hmm. What do you think about that?
Well, I didn't know much about this guy. He's a Scottish folk musician, Bert Jansch, and a founding member of the band Pentangle.
Indeed.
Now, I thought Pentangle was some sort of dark...
mystical.
Scary band that of devil worshippers or witches or something.
Yeah, that's probably why Jimmy Page, of course, covered it on Led Zeppelin 1. And virtually an identical arrangement, except there was no vocal. But, you know, there's a lot of controversy about this track, etc., because it is an old Irish traditional folk song, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
And but of course Led Zeppelin or Jimmy Page actually, you know, as they covered it on Led Zeppelin 1, and the similarities between the two, because Bert Jansch is a bit of an acoustic guitar genius, you know. He went on to do amazing stuff over the years, and he's done some great stuff. But you know, it is so similar. I listen to it and I think, wow, you know, Jimmy, that's a bit slightly naughty. But yet again, I haven't heard the original, so I don't know what it's supposed to sound like. Perhaps we should dig that out.
Well, funny enough, when I started looking into all this, okay, so apparently this is the Rude 564 variant or version of one of the first songs folk singer Anne Briggs taught Bert Jansch to play. And I think she really didn't like, at the time everyone was just kind of strumming in folk, and I think he inspired her because of his playing technique and the way that he was very intricate and quite beautiful. So they started playing together. And what was quite interesting, so they have this like category, all these old folk songs written down in this, and they have like a Rude system. I know they have different systems, but this is one of them anyway. But what I didn't realise as well is like they were talking about him being like one of the most important figures in contemporary British folk.
Yeah.
And now why didn't I know about this guy? It's so weird.
Well, John Renbourn, all those guys, you know.
I mean, it was just incredible. I mean, he was influenced. Neil Young cites him as an influence as well as Jimmy Page. And in fact, Neil Young went as far as in an interview with Guitar Player magazine, he said that Jansch did for the acoustic guitar what Jimi Hendrix did for the electric.
Yeah. Because he'd do unusual tunings. I think that's in Dad Gad. Or certainly the Jimmy Page one he's in.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, and also that sound he's got, it's like a really thin, and at the end he's bending those notes in a very unusual way, and he's using a little finger. I don't actually know he's doing it. I'll have to watch a video of him doing it. I must be one somewhere.
I have no idea what this guy looks like. I've just recently watched the BFG from he sounds like the giant in BFG.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's
You'd probably find he's a really, you
Roald
know.
Dahl's figure. Brilliant, the big friendly giant. But it's just like, because he's got this kind of country kind of feel to him.
Well, he's definitely got that classic folk lyric.
Yeah.
Hanging you with that nasal thing.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? But his influences, would you believe, were Big Bill Brunsey. And he also claimed that he'd still be a gardener if he hadn't discovered Brownie McGee.
Is that right?
Well, you know, obviously you're talking about Jimmy Page doing a version of Blackwater Side, mm-hmm. as well as Bert Jansch. Well, when I was looking at programming this song in, I found another band who did the same song. So I'm going to play a little bit of the first one by the first band. And then, anyway, just have a listen to this. So that was The Clash doing Police and Thieves. I just want to play a little bit of that because really what I wanted to play was this is the version performed by Junior Mervin, who actually wrote the song. Yeah. Junior Mervyn. Police and Thieves, released as a single, actually it was called Police and Thief, in May 1976 on Federal Records, Wildflower subsidiary label in Jamaica, then on the Mango label in the US and on Island Records in the UK. Now.
Well, I never liked The Clash. I thought they were terrible. Honestly. I mean, yeah. Joe Strummer was a bit of a legend and all that, but they never got me. They weren't like Sex Pistols, you know. It was, to me, they were very angry and stuff. But that track, you know, the first version of it, it's all out of tune. It's horrible. The guitar's out of tune. Right from the beginning, drum sounds horrible. It's horrible. Horrible.
That's why we didn't play it all the way through, actually.
Yeah, it stinks. I don't like The Clash. It stinks. They stink. Never liked him. Top of Head, and I remember meeting him, actually, backstage at, where were we? Ali Pali, I think. We were playing there with a band called Roadrunner. It was like punk blues at the time. And I met him, and he's a cool guy, you know. But you know, what they're trying to do, they had that British thing and they were trying to reinvent what Lee Scratch Perry had done so magnificently in Jamaica. Now, when you listen to the second one, you imagine it on a big sound system, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Club with like 4,000 people and then about 5,000 bass bins.
That's true.
Because we watched that program tonight about bass, and it was saying that on these sound systems there was more bass cabinets than people.
Yeah, and if you wanted to find a late night party, you just had to drive around and listen out for the bass.
Exactly.
Coming now, from a basement.
So, you know, we're talking a different thing. We got that lovely open phaser, a flanger on the guitar, that fantastic kick drum. It is groovier than a whole pile of groovers with an extra helping of super groove sauce.
And Ernest Wanglin's playing guitar on that.
I know, exactly.
And do you know he was born in Manchester?
No.
But Manchester in Jamaica. I got
you. You did? I thought, no, I can't remember it.
Yeah, I mean, what an amazing array. What happened was that, what do you read into it, right? Junior Mervyn went up and approached Lee Scratch Perry, the great producer in 1976, and auditioned the song at his Black Ark studio in Kingston, Jamaica. And he decided to record the song that afternoon. So he loved it. So he just changed some of the lyrics. I don't know whether or not that was because of artistic purposes or whether or not he meant it got a credit. I don't know. But you had Boris Gardner on bass.
Yeah.
Sly Dunbar on drums.
Now we're talking. Sly and Robbie. I mean, my goodness, what? It is just fiendish. That kick drum, when it comes in, it's just, and it's the timing of it. It's beautiful. Anyway. Sorry.
So there you go. Now that is the original. Yeah. And what a song.
Yeah, and what a production. What a sound.
I'm
And that was Tube Army, Our Friends Electric, from their second and final studio album, Replicas, released on April 1979, released on Beggar's Banquet Records in the UK, and ATGO, that's not ACDO, the washing powder, Atlantic Records in the USA.
I love Gary Newman.
Yeah, so do I.
I don't know what's happened, but ever since we saw that documentary, there's something about his music that's just really grown and matured over the years.
He's the real deal. And, you know, I listened to that again for the first time. And when that goes down, 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 in that guitar, yeah. That big fuzz guitar, If you listen to Wang Chung, that were actually formed in 1980, Jack Hughes, they've ripped that off. They've ripped it off. And I can't remember which track it is. We're going to have to play it in the next couple of weeks. But anyway, I just listened to it. I thought, wow, what a rip off the track. But anyway, Gary Newman, Chiwe Army. He started as a punk band, didn't he? Tube Army started as a punk band, yeah. And he discovered the Moog synth. He went into a studio,
that's
and there
right.
was a Moog, I think it was a mini Moog there, and he played the bass notes on it, and instantly he was hooked, and he threw away all the tracks that he was doing for his like punk album and decided to go electronic. And, you know, and I remember he said from the documentary that the record company went absolutely bananas. They didn't know what was going on. And, of course, the rest is history because, I mean, this was it number, how long was it number one for?
4 weeks.
Blimey.
It was released as a single in May 1979 and it was number one for 4 weeks. And the album reached number one in July 79. It sold over 100,000 copies. And he was actually the first band of the electronic era to have a synth-based number one hit song.
Yeah.
You can tell.
Yeah. And, you know, and he can obviously hear the inspiration from Kraftwerk there.
Yeah.
And the whole krautrock, you know, thing. I mean, it's a marvellous.
And also, did you know his influences were also the commercially unsuccessful John Fox-led incarnation of Ultravox?
Ah, I know our friend Mark Cleeter was very happy about that. Because Mark loves Ultravox. He loves everything to do with Ultravox. And Midge,
It's like Maestro Midge, isn't it, really?
Yes, he certainly has a
sweat
on.
His eyes glaze over when you talk about Midge. And in fact, he can't stop once he starts, can he, really?
Absolutely.
When it's about Midge-io. It's very funny, actually.
But John Fox, but you can hear.
And David Bowie.
The German albums, you know, the Berlin trilogy.
Yeah.
And you can hear it coming out, but I love his vocal. I love the use of the electric guitar in there as a texture rather than a solo thing, you know?
Yeah.
I love the fact that when you listen to the acoustic drums, because you'd expect it to be electronic drums, and I'm pretty sure it's acoustic drums on that. But the kick drum is not doing do do ga do. It's like it's doing a lot more beats than you think when you really listen to it. And it's the bass that's keeping that sort of sway motion going in that gut. So sort of, it's almost like a ship groove, isn't it? You know, when a ship's moving. And it's rolling slowly through the water. You know, that's what it sounds like to me. But the kick drum's doing something quite different. But of course, there's always the backbeat, which is carrying it through. Beautiful, great written song.
What I love is the fact he fused the electronic with rock and roll. So that you could see it was like a hybrid moment when things started to evolve, when he took those influences. But, I mean, it's so fresh. This is what gets me.
Yeah, it is. It's unbelievable. And I mean, all this stuff that we play on the show is from our vinyl collection, extensive vinyl collection. And when you dig these things out and listen to them again, they sound so fantastic. We've got this on. I'm 45 downstairs on a 12-inch, and it's just fantastic, you know? It jumps out the speakers at you, and all you want to do is dance around like an idiot, drinking whatever it is you're drinking at the time.
And I want to paint my face white as well.
Yeah.
One of those, and just like stare.
Well, I think we should do that and then go down to the pub. What do you think?
I think we need to go to the pub later on. And by the way, it's the end of the show now. We've got a last track to play.
No.
I know. Do you know, it's so funny. Right, I've got to say as well, right, you know our friend David Sundell, who's over in South Africa at the moment, he was saying actually that's one of his favourite parts of the show, isn't he? It's the end of the show. No!
Yeah, well, there we are.
And the thing is that you didn't know then because you were just talking about the track and I've suddenly realised we've got one more to play and that's it.
Well, you can check us out on Mixcloud, that's where we hang out, Spotify, iHeartRadio in the States, and you can get some Twitter.
And if you want to get hold of us, we're on Facebook and and Instagram, and thanks so much for joining us on these shows. You know, it really does keep us going, actually. It keeps us stimulated, I think, as we explore new music, old and new, really. Yeah,
and that's it. I think also what it does is that it's really, I think it's showing we've got a massive diversity of music. We're not just blues musicians. We even though we play stuff which is like that sort of sound, you know, we're influenced by all this great stuff, and it's so exciting, isn't it? We just love it.
So the final song of this week's show is by Santana, of all people, and a song called Black Magic Woman and Gypsy Queen, which was released as a single in 1970 and also appears on their second studio album, Abraxas, which was released on the 23rd of September in 1970 on the CBS label. And it went to number one in the charts, the album, and went quadruple platinum. I mean, this song is huge.
It is. And, of course, Peter Green wrote it. Which is the thing. And I think that Santana, I mean, the original's fantastic, but Santana did a marvellous job of it, you know, because the guitar sound, my God, it's just great. And, you know, it's that sustain, it's everything that Carlos Santana is, you know, and the band, you know, with that lovely Latin rhythm. It's just an amazing interpretation of the song. I know a lot of people actually don't like it. They say, oh, you know, it's Santana.
Do they?
Yeah, but I've always loved it, and it really turned me on to Santana, you know, and I was into Moonflower album with Europa, and the great stuff, you know.
It's got that kind of like dark sort of voodoo feel to it, hasn't it?
Yeah, and this is the reason why I bought a Mesa Boogie. I bought a Mesa Boogie because all the session guys in Manchester were using them, or in the UK at the time, the brand new sort of thing, the Mark II, and Carl Santana was using one.
So this is
the reason why I bought it.
Isn't that funny, though? You hear a song and it influences, the sound influences, and you'll go out and buy a piece of gear.
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely fantastic.
So this is a medley with Gabor Szabo's 1966 instrumental Gypsy Queen and sung by Greg Rowley.
Anyway, enjoy it. Carl Santana and his marvellous sustaining guitar. We'll be right back.
Thank you.